Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Above Politics Show. I'm Homer Fife.
And I'm Martin Bain.
Martin, you know what? I was looking at the news today, and this place is going insane, especially over where you're at.
I suspect we could be talking about a couple of things to do with the Royal Bank of Scotland, maybe, here. And one of the biggest ones is that the ex-boss of RBS, Sir Fred Goodwin, is receiving a fairly substantial pension, and a pension is typically the funding that you get at the end of your working career, which you've paid into for years and years. And his pot is around about £16 million, which gives him £650,000 a year for life, which is around about $900,000. So for the rest of his life, that's what he gets for running RBS into the ground and then forcing the British taxpayer to fork out billions of pounds, and yet we reward this man's failure. Even worse, the Minister for Business negotiated this deal with him, and Gordon Brown is now not very impressed, because he's now saying, I didn't know anything about this. And Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, is saying, I didn't know anything about that. Yet someone in the business department negotiated this, which, interesting.
Oh, I think it's more than interesting. I think Brown's response is classic. I mean, this man is infuriated, and you know, rightfully so. You've got a man that ran a business completely into the ground, and then he negotiates a settlement, more or less, of where he's receiving, and I think 650 billion or 650,000 was kind. I think it's 690 some thousand actually, for the rest of his life. And reading on to this thing, I just want to bring this up. One of the things that they're talking about, the development for this bank, is they're going to put $325 billion of toxic asset into a new government insurance program. How is that helping anything?
It's not. Plainly, this man was at best hardly qualified to run a bank. I don't think he actually had any formal qualifications. Had run the bank, yes, as you say, run it into the ground, and basically what the government are doing. And in reality, you have to consider that the Royal Bank of Scotland, all intents and purposes, is nationalised. Whilst we don't own 100% of it, we will own at least 75% of it. There's talk we may have to put a huge tranche of money in again, which may take us up to 90-odd%. So in reality, the British taxpayer, the British people own this bank. And yeah, here's a man, ran it into the ground. Now, you know, you can, if you want to try and defend him, you can. He has said, when he wrote back to the government saying, guess what, chaps, I'm not going to give up my £650,000 plus pension. You know, when I left the bank, I gave up my severance, I gave up my notice, I gave up my bonuses, I gave up my shares, which probably may have amounted to a fairly significant seven-figure sum. So he's sort of saying, well, this is the deal I negotiated. And I, whilst it's fundamentally wrong, if he's negotiated a deal with somebody in the government, there is a part of me that says, you know, my word is my bond. If they shook hands on it, you know, you almost have to say that is sacrosanct. Now, what we should be doing is questioning the minister who agreed this one. But what's also concerning me a little bit here, Homer, is that you've got the Prime Minister and the Chancellor saying, well, we didn't know anything about it. Well, hang on a minute. These people are running the economics of this country. You know, if they're cavalier with £650,000, just how cavalier are they going to be with billions of pounds of my money? It staggers belief that, you know, this is such a high profile thing that no one bothered to tell the Chancellor, who is in reality the CFO of Great Britain PLC and the CEO of Great Britain PLC. What else are these guys hiding? What else have these guys not got round to telling us?
Exactly. And you know what? I'll back you up on that, Martin. If everything comes down, if everything falls on this guy's head, then the mistake is ours, okay? Because he negotiated a deal. And like you said, whether hands were shaken or whether actual legal documents were drawn up, and it actually looks like they were, then this is the deal that he negotiated. And if I came to you, Martin, and I said, okay, I'm going to give you X number of dollars every year for the rest of your life because you did whatever, that's a deal I made with you. So The fault and the blame needs to go higher up. Exactly what you said. It's people saying they didn't know anything about this. There's the problem.
But you have to say the man that negotiated this was Lord Miners, who is, you know, a senior member of the business department. You know, you've got to be thinking this is sort of equivalent to a, you know, a divisional director or a divisional manager in a corporate business. You know, for him to sort of turn around and sort of, you know, try and say, ah, well, yes, I negotiated this. Great. But this man should have been advised about all of this. It smacks of desperation. It smacks of them basically trying to dive in, help RBS out. Yes, we can argue about whether they should have helped RBS out, but now they've done that, and all of a sudden you've got people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the UK are being made redundant, and here's a man that's going to have, you know, a pension fund, 650,000 plus. You have to think this guy's probably got several millions in the bank, you know, and there are no doubt going to be people in RBS who will lose their jobs and have lost their jobs because of the poor way that he and the rest of the management team are running RBS, and he feels no shame, and he's negotiated it. He's, my word is my bond, I'm fairly hot on that myself, but I just think it speaks volumes for the calibre of people that we have in government.
Well, I only have two comments on that. Number one, $900,000 will wipe away a whole lot of a person's shame, and number two, the guy's only 50 years old. He's my age. He can go back into this and make another fortune.
Well, of course he can. At some stage, he probably will go back in somewhere in business as a consultant, probably being paid, you know, a goodly sum. You have to question why you would want to employ someone that, you know, took a fairly successful bank and ground it into the ground. But I'm absolutely sure there are people eventually who will say, actually, this man can teach us something. Yes, I know what he can teach you. But even worse for the government and RBS is that they posted the largest loss in UK corporate history. For those of you that want the numbers, they are quite large. £24.1 billion, or $34 billion. So, staggering numbers that, you know, in essence, I, as the British taxpayer, you know, we're funding that. It's just staggering, you know. And you have to question what all these people who were running the banks in the UK, in the US, and in Europe, what have they actually been doing? You know, are we ever going to get to the bottom of, you know, what was going through their brains? I suspect the thing going through their brains was money. How much money am I going to make? How much bonus am I going to make out of this? And I suspect they just became greedy. They just started taking deals because they looked good on paper. Okay, who's responsible for that one? Well, you can say that the regulatory authorities were responsible. You can say that governments were responsible because they didn't put enough regulation in place. And I know you and I, and I know some of your rants have spoken about regulation, but in some respects, are we now getting what we sowed many years ago in the fact that we let so many financial institutions have less regulation than, looking back in hindsight, they should have had? Because now we've, you know, the US is spending trillions of dollars bailing banks out. We're spending, in essence, trillions of pounds bailing banks out. Across Europe, they've spent billions of euros bailing banks out, all because there seems to be a lack of oversight here.
Yeah, but Martin, we're not doing anything. And look, I'm going to defend my position on this. We're not doing anything but making matters worse. We need to get out of it. That's the problem. Bank is going to fail. Let it fail. Okay. And here's the understatement of the year. On the BBC World News website, there's a picture of the logo for the bank, and underneath it, it says RBS said 2009 will be another tough year for the bank. Yeah, duh. You know what? Businesses fail, Martin. Businesses fail every single day. And just because it's the size of the business, or just because the government has a certain substantial vested interest in the business itself, does not take away from the fact they're putting these billions of dollars of toxic asset into government insured funds. Look, the reason it's called a toxic asset for a reason, and all you're doing as a government is you're turning around guaranteeing more money that is simply going to be lost. The whole thing is nothing but a perfect example of the government sticking its nose in and making things work.
But ultimately, could governments have let, for example, RBS fail? Could you have let, you know, Freddie and Fannie fail? Could you have let, you know, Citibank go under? Could you have let Bank of America go under? You know, in some respects, I don't think you can. I think there are, in this day and age now, Homer, some businesses, basically, no matter how badly they perform, they are so intrinsic to an economy's well-being, governments will always have to bail them out. Say, for example, Ford. Ford went belly up tomorrow, are you trying to tell me that the US government would not just step in and pump billions of dollars into keeping Ford going purely because they cannot afford to let them fail?
Well, of course they would, but that's because, you know, we're now the United Socialist States of America, you know. But 50 years ago, would they let it fail? Absolutely. And should they let it fail? Absolutely. Is it going to put a lot of people out of business or out of work? Yes. Are we going to have soup lines? Yes. Are things going to be worse? Yes. But they will right themselves. And they're going to right themselves a whole lot faster if the government stays out of it and minds government business. Because what you're going to get now, Mark, is you're going to get the government stepping in until they can't step in anymore. And all of a sudden, it's not going to be the Royal Bank of Scotland is failing. It's not going to be Ford. It's not going to be General Motors. It's going to be the United States of America. And it's going to be the country of Great Britain. When those fail, then we've got a whole lot worse problem on our hands. And that's the problem. We are vesting ourselves as a government into corporations that are losing money and have proven they're going to lose money. So what happens when the government fail? What are we going to do then?
Oh, we're just probably going to have to go cap in hand to China and India and beg them to bail us out and become third world countries and become the next low-cost economies.
And that, you know what, Martin, you say that in jest, but you know what, it may not be that far off.
Yes, I think it is. You know, it's interesting to see how low-cost economies are rolling around the world. And yes, and you know, I have joked with friends that I know that it's just going to come back, and at some stage the United Kingdom will be the low-cost economy for China and India and the Far East. You know, we have to see what's going to happen there.
Exactly. Well, and you know, moving on here real quick, Mark, to all of our listeners in the United States, I would like to encourage you to, as quickly as you possibly can, get your tax forms done, send in for your refunds, because guess what, folks? The people in Kansas and the people in California are not going to get their state refunds. They have put a hold on them because of the economy, and that's your money, folks. That's money that was taken out of your check, and if under the current tax laws you are eligible for a refund, they are keeping your money.
Yeah, and you have to turn around and say, what are you going to do about it? There's probably not a lot you can actually do about it. And, you know, these states aren't doing it because they want to do it maliciously. They're obviously doing it for a very good reason, that if they pay out billions, or, you know, probably in the case of California, it could well be billions. I suspect Kansas is going to be hundreds of, you know, it's going to be hundreds of millions of pounds. You know, these states are just going to be even more bankrupt.
Now, let me ask you something, Martin. This ties right in with the Royal Bank of Scotland. If the countries, if our respective countries continue to bail out businesses that have proven themselves to be suspect at the very best and corrupt at the very worst, then they've got to get the money from somewhere, right? I mean, they could just print more money, but of course they did that back in the 1950s, and it's been proven that if they print themselves out of a recession, what's going to happen is just, you know, it goes into a pure blown out depression.
I think the technical term for printing more money is quantitative easing, I'm led to believe, which I think is a lovely phrase for printing money. But yeah, but it is interesting that, you know, why these states are having to do that.
They're having to do it because they're bailing out these businesses. You've got the states that are coming in because, I mean, let's look at it this way, Martin. The federal government has no money, correct?
Probably, yes, I would probably say that its tax take is probably dramatically reduced. So yes, it probably has limited funds.
Right, and what money it does have comes from us, from the people. Well, our money goes to the state, and then I mean, that's where the bulk of the money's coming from. So when we say we're bailing these banks out, or we're bailing Fannie and Freddie out, what we're really doing is we're taking our money, our state money, giving it to the federal government. The federal government's using it to. I mean, it's a wicked circle, and it's just going to get worse. And so right now, what they've done is they've already taken your tax money. So they're saying you can't have your refunds back because, sorry, we need it so we can bail out some other business that's run itself into the ground.
I suppose it begs the question is whether that's actually legal or not, whether a state can refuse to pay you back your if you've overpaid your taxes.
Well, they're saying they can. Says Kansas has halted them temporarily, but I think California's made it permanent. I don't think you're getting state refunds back in California.
But you have to think, that's you trying to tell me that no one is either has challenged this or is planning to challenge this? First of all, they're going to start in California, and then as soon as it doesn't get, as soon as one side loses, you know very well it's going to end up in at the Supreme Court at some stage.
I'd certainly hope so. However, it won't be me doing it, because guess what, Martin? I have all of my money back already.
Yeah, you have this year's money. What about next year?
Well, if I see this as being a trend, I'll tell you right now, I'll cut my tax back that they take out of my check, which you can do. I'll cut it back to bare minimum. Then at the end of the year, I'll just write them a check.
So, yeah, whereas in the UK, most people typically work in the UK on a concept called PAYE, which is pay as you earn. So you pay tax every week or every month, and then at the end of the year, the tax authorities work out whether you were under or mm-hmm. over and make some allowances.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now that's what I do, but I don't have to do that. I can say, okay, Mr. Federal Government or Mr. State Government, I don't want you taking any taxes out. Then they won't. And then at the end of the year, I have to file a certain form telling them how much I made, and then they'll tell me how much I owe.
Whereas I think in the UK, I suspect most employers, it would probably be an interesting thing to do to turn around and say, guess what? Let's actually have a go at that in the UK. So, hey, guess what? If there's someone out there in the UK who's maybe gone to their employer and they were on PAYE and has basically said, guess what? I want you to pay me gross and I'll sort it out myself. Interesting to see on that one.
It would be. Martin, I'd like to talk for just a minute, if it's okay with you, about more of the same. As we know, one of the platforms that President Obama ran on was he was going to bring all of our troops back. And I think people actually expected that to be overnight, although we knew that how ridiculous that was. But it seems like apparently now, according to Obama's speech at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, he made it in front of a bunch of Marines, it's going to be he's going to end the combat missions by August 2010 and have all the troops out by 2011. Now, guess when that timetable was first designed?
I know that. This is a legacy from your last president, George W. Bush.
Right. So Obama's not doing anything but what George Bush has already put in place.
But you have to suspect that why would he do anything else other than maybe bring it forward?
Well, I mean, that's apparently what he promised to do. I mean, wasn't that what he promised? That he was going to bring our boys and girls home and that all of this was going to end? I mean, and I think all of us expected it to end immediately.
I have to think that he probably had that as a mission statement, but I think maybe as soon as he got close to office and then into office, the realities of that situation probably presented themselves to him, and he probably had, no doubt, the military advisors, but maybe also the Iraqi people or the Iraqi administration saying, look, at the moment where we cannot afford for you just to walk out. So I suspect he's had to look at the political logic and the political reasoning on the ground here. Great, politicians say many things when they want your vote, but when they get into office, how do you cannot expect them to maintain that, because they'll turn around and say, but something I wasn't aware of has happened. And
exactly.
And that's exactly what's happened here. Yeah, it was a commendable thing to say and do, but reality now says you can't do it.
And that's the thing, isn't it? When they're running for office, they don't know their, as my grandmother would say, they don't know their butts from their heads. And so they make all these outlandish guarantees of things they're going to do. Then when they get in there, they get what I like to call the talk, which is where the people that really make the decision sit them down and go, no, wait a minute, you can't do this. This is the most you can do. And then they get reality hits them in the face.
But, and you have to guess, I wonder, where is he actually bringing troops home, or is he just going to move them to Afghanistan?
Good point, because I'm telling you, that's going to be Obama's legacy, is back in Afghanistan. And the amazing thing to me is, what is the old saying? We never learn anything from history, except we never learn anything from history. You know, Russia went in there, guns blazing, with, well, actually USSR, all of their incredible military might. And what happened to them? They got their butts kicked, their tail between their legs, yiping their way back home. And here we are going in trying to do the same thing. I don't know why we can't learn.
Because someone's made a decision here, and presumably intelligence still says that Taliban and Al-Qaeda are still a very serious threat. I mean, I suspect that's the reason why. I mean, I suspect, yeah, if you look back at history, you're right. The Russians tried it in Afghanistan, the British tried it in Afghanistan, and we got ourselves kicked. But if you look back, certainly in those two instances, it seemed that you were against the whole country. Whereas if you look at some of the stuff coming out of Afghanistan here, it seems to be not the whole country are against you. So therefore, I think it is going to be an easier task to actually do that, rather than, you know, the British, you know, in centuries gone, and the Russians in the last century were basically hated by everybody who went in there.
You got a point. However, let's talk for just a second. You had an interview.
I did, and that will be coming up after this show with Tim Page, who is a senior policy officer with the Trades Union Congress, which is sort of a body that a lot of unions, labor unions in the United Kingdom belong to. And it's sort of almost a trade body for unions, I suppose, is a good good word to describe it. And I had about 20 minutes with Tim, and we were talking about, you know, the value of a union and being a member of a union, particularly in these trying times. And we also touched about protectionism and some of the economic policy decisions that have been made in the past and some of the things that the Trades Union Congress would like to see in the future. So that interview is coming up after this show.
I would also like to invite our listeners to tune into the rant, because apparently the person you interviewed is pro-union, and as I am fairly vehemently anti-union, I thought I would rant on the union.
Ah, so what a show, rest of the show we've got for you. But remember, if we've said anything you agree with, you disagree with, or you've got an alternative view and we haven't aired it, you know what to do. You find the show threads, post away, and we'll jump in and we'll engage in a dialogue with you. But we are coming close to time, so we do have to wrap up because we have to put the interview on the end of this show as well. So I just want to say thank you very much for listening to the Above Politics show. I am Martin Bain.
And I'm still Homer Five.
And we'll see you next time on the Above Politics show. And I'm on the phone with Tim Page, who is Senior Policy Officer for the TUC, who leads on economic and industrial policy. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. And one of the things that I was interested in is the value of being a member of a union in any times. And I suspect probably being a member of a union is probably even more important in these more trying economic times.
Yes, I mean, trade unions negotiate for their members and they defend their members. So it's the job of the trade union to look after the interests of people at work. And the trade union has more influence than more people that belong to that trade union. So we would expect managers in companies to watch out for things like health and safety, to make sure that people aren't working hours that are too long, to make sure that they pay people fairly. But managers are also running the business, and sometimes it helps to defend and protect the interests of the workforce if they have an independent voice who speaks up for them, who speaks for them collectively, and can help them to get those fair wages and those good working hours and those good conditions that all of us want in work. Where relations between managers and unions are good, and in the vast majority of cases they are good, it's more of a working partnership between the manager and the trade unions, and actually often managers say that unions help them to make the better decisions in the long run. So it's a win-win, and trade unions, we're there to help people at work, to help them to get the best out of their working experience and to work with their companies.
But I suppose you must be fairly busy, or have been fairly busy, because unfortunately, as we all know, a lot of companies are laying people off. And I suppose it must sometimes create some conflicts in where, you know, the people who run the business, and I think we have to be brutal here and say businesses are in business to make money, vis-a-vis whereas, you know, you being the Trades Union Congress and all your trade union members are probably not necessarily interested in the business making as much money as it can, but protecting the rights of its members. So sort of in more trying economic times, I suspect the pressures on unions must be even greater, because ultimately management is just going to turn and say, well, we need to keep the business afloat, we need to let 10 people go because we need to reduce our costs.
Yeah, the bits you don't read about so much, you know, is the flexibility of both managers and trade unions when they negotiate. I mean, the whole purpose of negotiation is you sit down, you look at the situation, and you try to find an outcome that's the best outcome you can find for both parties. Now, there have been lots of job losses in the UK and around the world as a result of the economic downturn, and there are going to be lots more. So there's going to be pain in this for everybody. But it's our job to try to defend jobs where that's possible, to try to negotiate good payoff where that isn't. And a role that we're increasingly playing is to ensure that if the worst happens and workers do lose their job, they're in the best possible position to get another one. The trade unions are talking about skills more than ever before, because the best way for workers to protect themselves, both in their current job and to get a future job, is to have a skill. So whereas skills might have been, you know, priority number five, priority number six 10 years ago, it's right up there at the top now. But you're right, you know, difficult conversations happen. But in any relationship, difficult conversations happen. And the strength of the partnership is often defined by, you know, how you cope with a difficult conversation. And, you know, we're used to that, and managers are used to that. We're all grown-ups, and we approach these situations as grown-ups.
And to sort of put a very much on the spot, do you believe that the current government is doing enough to help and protect workers' rights?
In the UK?
Yes.
Well, I mean, we've had a marked improvement since 1997 from the government that went before. So, for example, the government introduced a national minimum wage, which we didn't have in the UK up until up until 1999 when the law went through. That meant that if there were a Scrooge employer, and sadly there are some, they could really pay as low as they wanted, and there was no law protecting the work. Similarly, the government gave new rights for people to belong to a trade union and to have that union recognised for collective bargaining purposes where it had a majority. And there's been movements forward on things like working hours and terms and conditions at work. But, you know, there are areas that we still need to work on. It's still easier to fire a worker in the UK than it is in many, many other European countries. Flexible workers get a particularly bad deal. Atypical workers, that means people who don't do your normal 9-to-5 job, get a particularly bad deal. You know, and we think the government could go further and so on those areas, and we do lobby and you know, we do try to put pressure on the government in order to do that. So, I mean, yes, it has done a lot, but there is more than it.
And do you believe that some of the legislation that's come out of the EU has helped union members and helped you ensure that you can represent your members better?
Yes, because the EU, I mean, as far back as the 1980s, adopted the policy of social Europe. It recognised that if it was going to have a single market in Europe, then there was a danger that employers across Europe would try to undercut each other. If employer X pays less than employer Y and works longer hours than company Y, then that company might have a competitive edge, but at the expense of poorly paid, harder worked workers. And, you know, we want to compete on the basis of high skills and high value, not on the basis of long hours and low wages. So the whole concept of social Europe, which said that alongside a market we need to have social protection, was one that trade unions across Europe were very much in favour of. And some of the laws that have come through Europe have come from that philosophy of social Europe. And it took the UK a long time to catch up with that, which was unfortunate. But, you know, so I think, you know, a lot of those laws that have come out of Europe have been very helpful to working people.
But I think certainly in the UK, many, many people who've read the newspapers will remember what happened at the Total refinery and, you know, and that blowing up. And I suspect a lot of that probably was blown up a little bit out of proportion. But clearly, I think a lot of people in the UK, Tim, would have a perception that jobs are not necessarily going to British workers. They're going to European workers, maybe from the new succession, newly succeeded countries to the EU, who maybe have a lower standard of living. So therefore are prepared to work for minimum wage. Where someone who's in the United Kingdom would say, well, I can't afford to work for minimum wage.
Well, I mean, I think the issue of freedom of movement in Europe should mean that any worker from any European country can go and work in any other European country. The situation at the Total refinery, I mean, I don't know exactly the details of what happened, but from my reading of it, the concern was that it didn't appear to be that those jobs were open to all workers from elsewhere across Europe, and it appeared to be that certain jobs were being held for workers, for a particular group of workers, and not open to all workers. And I think that was the concern in that situation. But so, you know, a level playing field is what we look for. And, you know, minimum wages are there to protect people at the lowest end. You know, we certainly support the principle of that.
So, and how does that, say, potentially extend outside of the EU? Because we have some recognised legislation to cover the EU. But where does the TUC stand on potentially protecting British workers, maybe from their jobs being subcontracted abroad, or maybe from employers who can potentially go maybe to parts of Africa, maybe to the Far East, and actually recruit workers who will work for the absolute minimum wage, and maybe take either bring those workers into the United Kingdom or actually export the jobs abroad where it is cheaper to employ people? And sometimes the legislations around health and safety and working hours and the ethics of working at are somewhat relaxed.
Well, I mean, there are two separate issues here. Firstly, we are fully supportive of the conventions of the International Labour Organization, which are around protecting the rights of workers across the world. The TUC signs up to that. We believe that, for example, any government contracts that are given to governments from around the world, we need to ensure that the workers that are doing that work are covered by the basic ILO protections that protect people at work. On the issue of exporting jobs, I mean, actually, it's a bit of a myth that you can just export jobs to different parts of the world as easily as that. Companies need to have a proximity to the markets that they're selling in. The costs of shipping goods around the world when they're produced in another part of the world adds adds to the difficulty of exporting jobs. And what we found was, whereas about 5 years ago, you know, people felt that it would be very easy to export the lower cost job, and that was known as outsourcing. A phrase that's come into the employment arena in recent years is backsourcing, and that's where jobs were exported abroad, but companies have found that actually it's more efficient to keep them close to the main workforce and close to the market. So that's less of a problem than people often think it is. There's a general principle that I think you're talking about. You know, in different parts of the world, there are different levels of wealth. There are people in parts that you mentioned, parts of Africa or parts of Asia, you know, where people work for extremely low wages, and the UK couldn't possibly compete on the basis of those wages. So the TEC's philosophy is very much that, you know, there are going to be areas of the world economy where we are going to be competitive, and there are going to be areas of the world economy where we're not. We're not going to be competitive in low labour costs, cheaply produced goods, because, like I say, workers in poorer parts of the world will always be able to do those jobs more cheaply. Where UK workers can compete is in the high skill, high value, high technology sectors, modern advanced engineering. You know, the Prime Minister is going to be using a phrase in a speech today: we need less financial engineering and more real engineering. And the TEC says amen to that. You know, new, green technology jobs, the kind of technology that's going to allow us to sort of heat our homes and power our cars, but in a way that is less polluting to the environment. These are all huge growth areas, and they are areas that, you know, with the right government support, UK workers could take advantage of and make a real success for the workers themselves and for our economy.
Okay, and certainly sort of, you know, Gordon Brown obviously is concerned with what's going on in the British economy. But I was just curious to see what the TUC view is of the amount of money that's potentially has been given to the banks, that if the government spent that on skilling up the UK workforce, just how much more efficient we'd actually be. Whereas instead of giving billions of pounds to the banks, you say, well, let's train and let's have a very highly skilled, highly motivated and very dynamic workforce. It seems a little bit at odds with some of the things that the TUC wants to do, that the government have said bailing out the banks is potentially more important than creating the right base for the UK economy.
It's a real dilemma, isn't it? Because the banks are in a great deal of trouble, and there's a strong argument to say that one of the reasons they're in a great deal of trouble is because of, you know, some pretty poor practices in recent years. But the fact is, the economy can't run without a banking system that works. So, you know, whilst many of us will have found it quite difficult to see that amount of money going into the banks, we really felt that there was no alternative to keep the banks alive. The issue is, let's learn the lessons and let's make sure that it doesn't happen again. And what's sometimes described as boring banking, you know, less risky banking, supporting long-term industries, supporting workers to skill, proper mortgages and proper support for people who might get into trouble paying their mortgage. And this is the kind of service that we want from banks, and that's what I'll be looking for in the future. Not keen on the amount of money that was put into Save the Banks, but it kind of had to be done. I think some of the bonuses that we hear talked about, paid by some kind of very senior bankers, is leaving a bit of a nasty taste in people's mouths, you know. I'm not talking about the cashier who cashes your cheque when you pop into your local bank, you know, who probably works hard, is working to targets and deserves that bonus. And, you know, I'm talking about those very senior executives with higher bonuses. I think a lot of people feel uncomfortable about that. And what the TUC wants to see is investment in the areas that are going to make our economy strong, the areas that you mentioned in your question, investment in skills, you know, so that we can be among the best skilled workers in the world, investment in innovation, investment in the kind of long-term industries that you can build long-term economic strength on, you know, not housing bubbles or, you know, complex financial instruments, not wheezes to make a bit of money on the quick, but building long-term companies that can export goods abroad, that can build the best in the world and provide secure jobs and secure future for British workers. That's our vision.
Okay. And is there anything else you feel that the government needs to be doing to support British industry? I mean, you know, maybe about, you know, maybe guaranteeing exports and things like that, and maybe creating and I suppose it's always an interesting point here, is that a lot of businesses that I talk to say they want less regulation, but I suspect less regulation has a downside sometimes, in that less regulation may end up in workers being vulnerable or being exploited by the employer.
That's exactly right. We'd be interested at the TEC to talk about better regulation, but I don't think that's the same as less regulation. Nobody wants excessive burdens on what they do. I suspect most of your listeners will have gone into work and got caught up with red tape, or got caught up with, you know, things that stop them getting on with their day-to-day jobs, and we all want to minimise that. that, and the trade unions recognise it's not in the interest of the companies that their members work for that they're tied up in excessive regulation. But where regulation is removed to the point that proper protection for workers is denied, then that's a separate issue. So, you know, I don't think there's too much to be done on the issue of regulation. I mean, I would like to see the government set out a vision of how it wants the economy, how it wants industry, and how it wants society to look in 5 or 10 or 15 years' time. The reason the TEC talked about strategic industries, scientific industries, manufacturing, engineering industries, competitive industries. You know, we're talking about green technology. We're talking about how to ensure that we have a fairer society so that the gap between those who earn so much at the very top and those who earn so little at the very bottom can be narrowed. Now, there are people in our society, you know, who work extremely hard, but however hard they work, they're trapped into a spiral of low wages and low skills that they just can't get out of. And we need to address that, and we want to create a society that's comfortable with the sharing of wealth a little bit more. A country that's more comfortable with wider education, greater knowledge of science, for example, which is something that government's talking about at the moment. Greater access to culture, greater access to what it is to be a human being in the world today. How we can build an economy and a society that supports people to get the very best out of their life. And this economic downturn, you know, is terrible. It's terrible with the job losses and the housing losses and the physical and emotional strains that it's going to put on people. But it just might offer us an opportunity to look at how we structure our economy and our society and to ask if we can do a little better in the next 20 years than we've done in the last 20 years. And once that opportunity is lost, it won't come along again for a long time. So I hope we can grab that opportunity and talk about the kind of country we want to be.
Okay, I had a couple of more questions before we wrap up, Tim. Do you believe the government should have seen this economic downturn coming? Does the TUC believe they could have done more to, I'm not saying they could prevent it, but they could, do you believe they could have done things to lessen the effects?
I mean, I don't think anyone saw it coming, but I think, the old phrase, you wouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. We felt in the UK that the government was proud of the financial services sector, quite rightly, it's a world leader, but there was so much emphasis on financial services to the detriment of other industries. And we just felt that a better balance would have been appropriate. So more of a focus on manufacturing, more of a focus on highly skilled services alongside financial services, so that if one of those sectors hit problems, we wouldn't lose quite so much as if we put so much emphasis on one sector. And in fact, the financial services sector, which is the one that did get into difficulty. So, I don't think anyone could have seen it coming, but I think the lesson is a balanced economy, a balanced society, if you won the jackpot on the lottery, you wouldn't put it all in one place. You wouldn't buy shares in just one company because, if that company got into a problem, you'd lose the lot. You'd spread it around. And it's that kind of philosophy that I think was missing.
And certainly when I talk about the trade union movement before we put this piece in the show, Tim, typically in the UK, the trade union movement, the trade union Congress has been probably more allied to the Labour Party. And there's a lot of people saying potentially the Conservative Party may get into power the next election. Do you see them having, I mean, clearly I think they would have a different vision of the economic landscape of the United Kingdom. Do you have concerns going back to having a Conservative government? Because, certainly during the Thatcher era, there were a lot of laws put in place that you would probably say restricted the rights of unions to protect their members. So I'm just curious to see how the Trade Union Congress sees the future, maybe under a Conservative government.
Well, some members of the TUC, some of our member unions are affiliated to the Labour Party. And some of them aren't. The teachers' unions, the civil service unions are not affiliated to the Labour Party. And neither is the TUC. We work with governments, or we try to work with governments of all parties. The Labour Party grew out of the trade union movement, so it's natural to assume there's a kind of an affinity of views between us. And I certainly think it's true that the Thatcher government was very hostile to trade unionism. But we keep links up with all the political parties, and if there's a Conservative government after the next election, we will look to work constructively and positively with that government. And with a bit of goodwill on both sides, I've no reason to believe that couldn't happen.
OK, Okay. And if our members wanted to know more about the Trade Union Congress, is there a website they could go to?
There is a website. We are at www.tuc.org.uk, where they can find out about the trade union that might be relevant to them in their particular job. There are about 60 trade unions affiliated to the TUC. That's not an exact number, but there are about 60, varying from big unions in manufacturing and engineering to some quite more specialist unions representing people like chiropodists and radiographers. We'd welcome people getting in touch with their relevant union and joining. And it would be good for people to learn about the range of things that we do, because sometimes, you know, if there's an industrial dispute or a struggle, people often hear about a trade union, but they are less likely to hear about the hard work that trade union representatives do every day on skills and on health and safety and on, you know, cleaning up the environment in which people work and ensuring that people have a better working experience. So I hope people log on to our website and find out a little more about us.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for your time. I certainly do appreciate that. And just for our listeners, I will put the link to the TUC website up on the show notes. So I want to thank you very much, Tim, and certainly appreciate the time today.
That's my pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Homer Fife, and this is Just the Way I See It. Unions. As Martin's guest spoke in support of unions, I thought I would take a moment of your time and present to you the other side of the issue. Okay, now, look, unions were indeed important way back when. You know, child labor, racism, etc. They were all prolific, and there was a need for people to unite. Enter the union. However, I would suggest to you that no one back then had any idea of the rabid animal the union would become. Self-perpetuating and omnipotent, they have truly taken on a life of their own, and they no longer serve to represent the common worker. But instead, they spend their entire time laboring and lobbying to represent only the interests of those at the top of the tier that subsist entirely because of the union. And I'm going to show you why later on. But in point of fact, they are nothing more than a strong right arm of the Democrat or Liberal Party. No matter what way the majority of their constituents may choose to vote, their dues, their money, goes directly into the pockets of the Liberals. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a fact. Now look at the mess the United Auto Workers have gotten themselves into. Wages out of control, to the point where the unions are driving the very businesses into the ground, the businesses that their people depend on for a paycheck. How much good will the unions be when the company is forced to go bankrupt because the very same unions force them to pay an unrealistic wage? Let me tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, $30 an hour is a whole lot better than nothing. But yet they're still striving to pay this $74 an hour, and they insist on these stupid wages. And how about this job bank? That's right, let's pay a man to sit at home over $30 an hour, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and he can legitimately turn a job down because he may have to move. He can turn a job down and still draw his pay. How out of control is that? He's making more money than me to sit on his butt and do nothing. Isn't it enough that we have a Democrat-controlled House, Senate, and administration that soon's going to be telling us what television or radio channel we can listen to without having our very own unions tell us what and where we can work? You know, if the unions are so great and so represent the little man, why don't they step up and take some of that lobbyist money, the millions of dollars that they spend, and support the very businesses that support their constituent? Huh. Now that's a thought, isn't it? Instead of having the government step in and bail these people out, why don't the unions? Because eventually, what's going to happen is the same thing that happened with United Mine Workers. They're eventually going to shut, and look, the United Mine Workers are still going strong, just not in my state of West Virginia. Because what happened there was they drove them out. The unions drove the businesses into the ground to the point of where they couldn't afford to stay in business and still pay the amount of money the unions demanded. So now there are literally hundreds of thousands of miners out of work, sitting at home, drawing welfare or cutting timber at the age of 70, just to put food on their tables. My uncle happens to be one of them. So before you go willy-nilly supporting a union because it's the great United States way, take a look at what you're supporting. Take a look at what they've become. Now, there are still some legitimate reasons and legitimate support for unions. I'm talking about these monsters, the United Auto Workers, United Mine Workers. You know exactly who I'm talking about. This is Homer Fife, and it's just the way I see it.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.